Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Grocer Who Sold McCarthyism, The Rise and Fall of Anti-Communist Crusader Lawrence A. Johnson, by Fred M. Fisk, narrated by Patrick Lawler. Introduction. By the spring of 1951, Lawrence Ayres Johnson, a self-made supermarket mogul in Syracuse, New York, had joined the fight against communism. Fueled by patriotism, he leveraged his platform as a major merchandiser to put pressure on the nation's broadcasters, whom he believed employed too many suspect actors. He drew inspiration from his adult daughter, Eleanor Buchanan, an outspoken critic of any American who was aligned with the Communist Party, or who just opposed U.S. involvement in the Korean War. Her husband was then with the U.S. Marines fighting the communists in Korea. Grim radio reports and battlefield images on the new medium of television stoked her alarm. Johnson quickly transcended the ranks of ordinary anti-communist citizens. He brought to the cause the skills he pioneered in the booming retail marketplace following World War II. His manipulation of the levers of merchandising soon had an outsized effect on the broadcasting industry and its major advertisers. Many complied with the demands of Johnson and his associates to blacklist hundreds of actors, writers, and others in show business. These lists, widely circulated among employers, contained the names of individuals deemed to be associated with or sympathetic to communism or leftist ideologies. It was a secret club no one wanted to join, as the listed individuals were effectively barred from obtaining work. For a time, Johnson's efforts were met with widespread support amid a climate of fear. Newspapers in the early 1950s offered one sensational headline after another alleging communist spy rings, a fifth column of Americans working to undermine the capitalist way of life. FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover claimed that for every U.S. communist, there were 10 fellow travelers. However, while Soviet spy rings and espionage did exist, whatever influence communism ever had in America was on the wane by the 1950s. The party never came close to overthrowing capitalism. It never had the chance. A half-dozen federal laws between 1939 and 1954 set up American communists for harassment, investigation, and jail. It was officially illegal to be an active party member. In 1951, U.S. Supreme Court Justice William O. Douglas described American communists as the best known, the most beset, and the least thriving of any fifth column in history. Soviet dictator Joseph Stalin's show trials and other repressions had disillusioned many U.S. party members. Circulation of the Sunday Worker, the American communist newspaper, fell from 65,000 in the 1940s to less than 29,000 in 1953, the year of Stalin's death. By 1962, an estimated one of every six party members was a government agent assigned to secretly infiltrate the communist organizations. Communism's prospects had been brightest in the grim 1930s, when Depression-era throngs turned to the party for solidarity and hope. Most American communists were nonviolent idealists on the left fringes of politics and society, ideologically devoted to the working classes and civil rights for all, while also deferring to Moscow and the shifting party line. They were effective labor organizers, and they advocated for black citizens long before Selma and Montgomery. However, the party never had much electoral clout. The Communist Party candidate in the 1932 presidential election earned 102,785 votes, trailing the Socialist Party's 884,000, both of whom finished far behind Democrat Franklin Roosevelt's winning total of 22 million. During World War II, Americans warmed to Russia as their ally against Germany's Hitler, Italy's Mussolini, and Japan's Tojo. That support waned in the post-war years when the growing influence of communism abroad sparked renewed investigations on federal, state, and local levels. In 1947, the U.S. House Committee on Un-American Activities, HCUA, held hearings that exposed alleged communist writers and directors in Hollywood. New allegations of subversion seemed to surface daily, and loyalty boards emerged at all levels of government across the country. Thousands of Americans lost their jobs, including teachers, lawyers, social workers, longshoremen, electricians, mine workers, sailors, journalists, and factory workers. In 1950, the outbreak of war in Korea became a litmus test for American patriotism. When the Communist Party called for resisting war production, it further dimmed its political prospects, particularly in labor unions. Communists neither posed a significant threat to the American social order, nor were they ever perceived as such. In opinion polls listing the nation's number one problem throughout the 40s and 50s, communism peaked at just 9%. Yet in mid-century America, there was no shortage of politicians, newspaper columnists, veterans, business leaders, and others eager to follow the lead of U.S. Senator Joseph McCarthy in targeting the inroads of communism, real or not. This anti-communist fervor found an eager disciple in Lawrence Johnson. Though family necessity limited his schooling, he possessed a keen mind, lively ambition, and a gift for innovative thinking. Known to his friends as Larry, he loved Americana, becoming an author of numerous articles on American folklore. His particular interest was the old country store, like the one in rural Wayne County in upstate New York, where he got his first job. Never a church-going man, Johnson became an evangelist of Americanism. The Declaration of Independence was his Apostles' Creed, the Constitution his Bible, Columbia the earthly manifestation of the divine. In these, he took to heart the values that would sustain him through his anti-communist campaigns. Never a military man either, Johnson made common cause with anti-communist veterans groups in the same spirit that led his ancestors to fight first the Redcoats, then the Confederates. In 1954, the National Veterans of Foreign Wars awarded Johnson a citation and good citizenship medal for his anti-communist efforts. His was a palpable patriotism, much like that captured in an American Legion flag salute from the 1940s. Our comrades saluted that flag for its red stripes of sacrifice, the color made fast in the shed blood of thousands of our strongest, best, virile manhood. We salute the white stripe of purity, washed clean with the tears of the wives and mothers and daughters who stayed behind and mourned those who never came back. We salute it for the blue field of constancy that has never wavered in its idea of freedom, and we salute it for the twinkling star of hope that even in this dark hour shines out to all the world undimmed in its luster and in its glory. Johnson and his allies took at face value the Marxist-inspired dictum, "There is not, nor can there be, a sphere or field of work that cannot be won by the communists." In Johnson's case, he was determined to silence the voices of American communism on radio and TV, no matter that those voices were weak and largely ignored. Johnson believed the language of subversion adopted subtle and seductive tones, influencing the American public through the dream factories of Broadway and Hollywood, and now also television studios. Johnson feared that communist performers, writers, producers, and directors could promote the party line, luring fellow travelers to play supporting roles and to further the cause, their words reaching millions, their generous salaries fattening party coffers. The few Communist Party true believers writing in Hollywood would have loved to tilt their scripts toward the party line, but overthrowing capitalism always came second to earning a living. More often, the frustrated writers worked on scripts for Jukebox Jenny and Bachelor Daddy. For every socially conscious film like What Price Glory or The Grapes of Wrath, there were a dozen escapist productions like Earth vs. the Flying Saucers and Zombies of Mora Tau. The 1950 publication of the anti-communist pamphlet Red Channels provided an easy-to-use guide for Johnson and others to identify actors and other show people with links to groups on the Attorney General's list of subversive organizations. Despite this blacklist, many of these performers were still active in show business in 1951. To Johnson, this represented both a national security threat and a personal affront. Applying his business acumen to the situation, Johnson devised a counterattack. Since broadcasting was a commercial enterprise, he reasoned that it would be vulnerable to commercial pressure. If he could persuade advertisers and manufacturers who sponsored the programming to pressure the radio and TV networks, the message might get through. On this front, Johnson was in familiar territory. He had been one of the first to distinguish the outlines of the dawning consumer era in the 1920s. At that time, the retail industry prioritized the needs of food brokers, wholesalers, and producers. Grocers were beholden to their suppliers, and customers had limited options on the shelves. Assembly lines accelerated production, increased profits, and offered lower-cost goods. However, many shopkeepers were slow to modernize their approach to delivering products to customers. Enter Lawrence Johnson. He set about transforming the country store into the cash-and-carry supermarket. By reversing market priorities and relationships, he put the needs and desires of the customer first. Manufacturers and suppliers henceforth would ignore the point-of-purchase consumer at their peril. The retail revolution that Johnson led meshed with the productivity boom in the 1940s and 1950s. As advertisers devised strategies to market competing brands, Johnson's supermarkets became a stage for their bright new packages, assembling an ever wider array of merchandise and moving an ever larger volume of goods to the consumer. Initially met with skepticism, the supermarket model rapidly gained popularity. Soon, these new palaces of consumption, lauded for their efficiency, logic, and cost-effectiveness, became commonplace. By prioritizing the customer, Johnson helped move the American dream several steps closer to reality. In his view, offering a selection of frozen fryers was a way to put a chicken in every pot. This vision of democratic pluralism gave customers freedom of choice within their budget, granting them access to a widening selection of products and sales pitches fueled by American ingenuity, enterprise, and salesmanship. Descended from the old country store, the modern supermarket remained a crossroads where manufacturer and consumer met, where a nation's productive energies were harnessed, its artifacts displayed, inspected, and acquired in glorious profusion. By the 1950s, 60% of the products advertised on television were sold in supermarkets, which meant these store owners had major influence with manufacturers and broadcasters. Johnson owned a chain of 6 supermarkets in central New York, and he was a national leader in the food service industry. If he went to the networks as an ordinary private citizen and asked them to fire the Reds, the executives would ignore him. But if he managed to interrupt the flow of sponsored products from the manufacturer to his customers and persuaded his fellow merchants to do likewise, or better yet, if he just mentioned it, well, the networks might take notice. He was right. They did. Between 1951 and 1955, Johnson held something close to veto power over show business casting in the studios, on Madison Avenue, and in the network boardrooms. Key to his success was enlisting sponsors to pressure ad agencies and broadcasters. Everywhere he found eagerness to cooperate, to avoid controversy, and forestall product boycotts. Year after year, even those in advertising who deplored Johnson's anti-communist merchandising tactics were unable or unwilling to defy him. The corporate sponsors of television or radio shows would often panic whenever Johnson claimed their products promoted programming that featured what he called Stalin's little creatures. Ad agencies stopped buying time on programs employing blacklisted showpeople. The networks went along. Talent agencies navigated the currents, seeking safe passage for their clients. All played their parts in this shadowy dance, second-guessing a jittery nation whose people mostly wanted peace and quiet and a chance to get ahead, and who didn't care much for liberals, atheists, or nonconformists, much less communists and their sympathizers. In yielding to Johnson and his commercial pressure, broadcasters sidestepped due process, freedom of speech and association, the presumption of innocence, and more. It was strictly about bottom line, market share, or, as the studios often claimed when they sent out the termination slips, audience ratings. Johnson's critics looked at him as a small-minded provincial tradesman out of his depth, obsessed with paranoid fantasies of communist subversion, cruelly assassinating reputations and careers. To this day, many regard the anti-communism furor of the 1950s as the McCarthy era, a dark period when the nation was held captive by an ugly combination of fear, intolerance, and indifference. According to these anti-anti-communists, the blacklisters represented the real threat by exploiting the nation's insecurities, sweeping up innocent liberals in their nets, stifling free expression and creativity, and trampling on civil rights. To Johnson's critics, the anti-communists snatched opportunity from loyal Americans who dared to imagine a better, more equitable society. In their view, the targeted were the heroes. It took courage to defy congressional committees, proudly plead the Fifth Amendment against self-incrimination, refuse to name names, sacrifice their own careers, and sometimes go to jail. On the other hand, decades later, many conservatives still see Johnson and his fellow anti-communists as justified in their dire warnings, if not always their methods. Plentiful evidence has emerged over the years to buoy their claims that, indeed, there was a communist influence in government, labor unions, and various professions, including entertainment. The end of the Soviet Union in 1990 provided access to KGB archives. Along with the release of the code-breaking Venona Papers starting in 1995, this new evidence documented Soviet-backed espionage and covert activity by hundreds of Americans up to the highest levels of government. Even if they weren't hardline Communist Party members trying to establish a Stalinist regime in America, they were doing their best to promote Moscow's interests. Communists not only supported Henry Wallace's Progressive Party campaign for president in 1948, they helped to lead it. Zealous anti-communists such as Johnson were, in many ways, unremarkable Americans, notable more for their representative traits than for any demonic attributes. Not a clubman by nature, Johnson joined organizations but shunned leadership roles outside his business interests. He had no congressional or executive mandate to pursue subversives. What was in it for him? Nothing financially. He never recouped the thousands he spent on his anti-communist work. The flame of his influence flared for only half a decade. In 1956, he finally faced a challenge he could not overcome, a libel suit brought by blacklisted entertainer John Henry Falk. At the New York City show trial 6 years later, celebrated attorney Louis Neiser sued on behalf of Falk. Johnson and his co-defendants were represented by attorney Thomas Bolin from the law firm of former McCarthy aide Roy Cohen. Many in the entertainment business held out hope the trial would snuff out the final embers of anti-communist civic activism in America. Even before the verdict, Lawrence Johnson's reputation as a shrewd marketer and a supermarket patriot had been irrevocably tarnished, his legacy seen as something akin to damaged goods. Chapter 1. A Rooted American. Lawrence Johnson's family lore is entwined with American history, right back to the early years of colonial settlement. A maternal ancestor, Walter Palmer, helped found Stonington, Connecticut, where he died in 1661. Another maternal forebear, Captain Roger Clapp, sailed from England to the Massachusetts Bay Company around 1630, as John Winthrop was establishing the settlement of Boston. Clapp was just 21 years old. He and his wife apparently thrived in the New World. The names of some of their 14 children bear witness to their sturdy, nonconformist faith. Preserved, Wait, Thanks, Desire, Unite, Supply, Experience, Hope Still, and Wait Still. Many of Johnson's ancestors were farmers or commercial traders. Among the first merchants in Connecticut was Thomas Stanton, who had arrived in Virginia as a boy. His trading prowess with the Indians up and down the eastern seaboard earned him appointment as interpreter by the Massachusetts Bay Company. Johnson wrote later that it was to Stanton that Uncas, the last of the Mohegans, went to have his will drawn up. In 1638, the Connecticut General Court granted Stanton exclusive trading rights with the Indians. He eventually built a trading establishment in Hartford. Family records note that Indians killed Roger Bartlett, another maternal forebear, in Northampton, Massachusetts, on March 4, 1684. Johnson's great-great-grandfather, Edmund Johnson, fought for Rhode Island in the Revolutionary War. Another ancestor, Nathaniel Ayers, was a private in New York's Sussex Regiment. A thrilling tale is told about another maternal ancestor, Lucretia Minor. After fleeing from Indian attacks in Pennsylvania's Wyoming Valley, she and her family suffered through lean years, eventually finding themselves interned in Fort Oswego, New York, then in British hands. Evidently, her trial had not dampened her spirit. In one confrontation, she was said to have pressed against the crossed swords of British bayonets until they drew blood. She and her family escaped when Fort Oswego fell to the Indians, or so the story goes. Another ancestor, Amos York, also landed in British custody in Oswego during the Revolutionary War after he refused to swear allegiance to the crown. Though the experience left him and his family penniless, they eventually managed to resettle and rebuild their lives in Connecticut. By the mid-1800s, many of Lawrence Johnson's forebears were farmers whose homesteads dotted the Northeast: Stonington, Connecticut, Newbury, Massachusetts, Woodbridge, New Jersey, and Trumansburg, Stillwater, and Savannah, New York. When the Civil War broke out, Johnson's great-grandfather, Morris Craw, looked after the farm, while his twin sons went off to do battle for the Union. Johnson's uncle, Lawrence, became a Union officer. A politicized farmer. Lawrence Johnson's paternal grandfather, Thomas Johnson, was born in 1812 in Stillwater, New York. Tall at 6'2" and athletic as a young student, Thomas was known to walk 40 miles in one day. Thomas moved to the Savannah, New York area about 1835. There he met Ancianda Craw, perhaps on a visit to old Morris Craw's tavern on the post road between South Butler and Spring Lake, where Ancianda cooked for and served the traveling clientele. They married on March 5, 1840, and had two sons. Thomas Johnson taught school in South Butler, and he took on the job of local justice of the peace. He served one term in the New York State Legislature. But Thomas didn't take to Albany. He had little patience for the florid rhetoric of 19th-century statesmanship. An intensely religious man, he shunned profanity. His favorite imprecations were, "Gosh all hemlock," and "Consarn it." Family records tell that upon hearing a speech by one spellbinder in Savannah, he remarked that he had never heard such a diarrhea of words and such a constipation of thought. Ansianda Craw Johnson made good use of the skills she had learned at her father's tavern. Her salt pork with milk gravy and mashed potatoes became family legends, as did her cakes, cookies, and pies. She also earned a reputation for maintaining order in the household and remaining calm in adversity. According to family lore, Thomas returned to the house one afternoon to read the paper. When he was ready to go out again, he couldn't find his straw hat. After working himself up into a lather, he confronted his wife, suggesting she had put it somewhere. She replied demurely that she hadn't even seen it on his head when he came in. He stormed out, only to return a moment later with a sheepish grin to confess, "It was up behind a beam in the hog pen." In an 1875 letter to his sons, Thomas wrote an eloquent assessment of his life's work, concluding that, "Providence has led me to reflect on the past, and as I do so, I can't but exclaim, 'Oh, how merciful and good God has been to unworthy me! 40 years ago I came into this country a poor boy, and by the aid of your dear mother and a kind Providence, I also may add my children, we have secured a good earthly home.'" A bold venture. Lawrence Johnson's maternal grandfather, Stephen Beckwith Ayres, was born in Trumansburg, New York, in 1819. He showed his mercantile talents early, working in bustling country stores. He married Artemisia Dunlap of nearby Ovid, and the couple settled in Penn Yan. Stephen and Artemisia made a handsome couple and enjoyed the finer things in life. They accumulated an estimable library, a rarity in the farm country of central New York. After working for nearly 2 decades in other people's stores, Stephen Ayres was seized with the idea of moving west and becoming a frontier entrepreneur. In 1857, the family moved to Fort Dodge, Iowa, which had a population of less than 1,000. There, Stephen Ayres set up shop in a small 2-story brick building with a wooden awning out front and a sign on the facade proclaiming S.B. Ayres. The business prospered. A picture postcard of downtown Fort Dodge, prominently featuring the Ayres Emporium, looks so perfect for the era it could be mistaken for a Hollywood backlot set. By the time their daughter Ida was born, April 11, 1858, her father had become a civic leader with interests in real estate and banking. He became the local agent for the Aetna Fire Insurance Company of Hartford. Eager to attract immigrants, Stephen advertised passenger tickets from Liverpool, England to New York at current rates. As Fort Dodge grew, other merchants competed for customers. Stephen resisted his competitors' practice of carrying whiskey in a customer's barrel with a handy tin cup. With his sober business sense, he combined a keen understanding of the value of advertising and maintaining high visibility in newspapers. One indication of the healthy volume of his business was his advertisement that ran on January 17, 1865. "Wanted, $20,000 worth of prime furs for which the highest market price will be paid." 2 months after that notice appeared, Artemisia Ayres died. Her health had been declining, but her death nonetheless shocked the family. Little Ida, not yet 7, was a bright girl whose mother had spent time reading to her from the family library, books on subjects ranging from botany to Latin. Artemisia had instilled in her daughter a love of learning that Ida would pass on to her own children. Without his beloved Artemisia by his side, Stephen lost interest in the Fort Dodge adventure. He sold out and returned to Penn Yan as a wealthy man. he retreated to his library and cultivated other interests, among them ownership of the Yates County Chronicle. He died at 68 on November 23, 1887, 2 years before Ida gave birth to Lawrence Johnson. A farm couple. Lawrence's father, Francis Marion Johnson, was born May 17, 1852, in the family's log.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?